This is KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. I'm Jenny Nyman, and you're listening to Adventure Talks on the Kenai Conversation. We're talking about the Valley of 10,000 Smokes, site of the largest volcanic eruption of the 20th century, in Katmai National Park and Preserve. Just a hop, skip, and a jump, or a flight, bus ride, and hike away from the Kenai Peninsula. I'm talking to Kathy Bell, Chief of Interpretation and Education at Katmai National Park and Preserve, about the geology of the valley and what it takes to plan a visit. Hi, Kathy. Thanks for taking time to talk to me today.
Thank you.
How long have you been at Katmai?
I'm pretty new at Katmai. I've worked here for just about 1 year.
Nice. So what do you like about being there?
Well, I like everything about being here. I have an undergraduate degree in geology and a master's in plant biology. So the combination of the volcanoes that we have here in Katmai and the really pretty incredible tundra and vegetation that we have is just, I'm in heaven.
Being pretty recently to Katmai, what was your impression going to the Valley of 10,000 Smokes for the first time?
Oh, well, I had a couple of first times seeing the Valley of 10,000 Smokes. My very first time was on a Cessna 185 tour of the park when I was flying around and getting to see the entire landscape of the place for the first time. That was in March, and so the entire Valley of 10,000 Smokes was under snow. And so I was able to get a sense of its vastness, and I was able to see where Nova Rupta was, the vent that caused the Valley of 10,000 Smokes to form. I was able to see the big lava dome, but I was in the air, and I didn't get to set foot on the ground in the Valley of 10,000 Smokes until the very end of May, when my staff came out, and we were finishing up training. So everyone who worked at Brooks Camp, we all went out to the Valley of 10,000 Smokes together, and that was my first time seeing it. And I was blown away. I had expected it to be kind of uniform tan in color, and I knew it was big, but my sense of scale was still just so I was so surprised by the sheer scale, the vastness of this valley, as well as by how colorful it was.
The color was what shocked me the most. And trying to wrap your head around vast, for sure. But, you know, if you've gone to the Grand Canyon or even the Badlands, I mean, you see some geology that's on a pretty big scale and pretty awe-inspiring. But the color, I had no idea, especially when you're just at that cabin overlook or, you know, first hiking out there and you get the first view of the valley.
Yeah.
From a distance, it's just this kind of drab, grayish, brownish, just wasteland-looking thing. And it's striking because, you know, it's this huge vista. But when you actually get walking out there, it's like you're in some kind of crazy psychedelic painting, mosaic kind of thing. The colors were just really, really surprising.
Yeah. The word moonscape gets thrown around a lot when people are trying to describe what the Valley of 10,000 Smokes kind of feels like. And I think that that does apply in some ways, especially when you're thinking about the valley as a whole, but it doesn't capture that feeling that you get when you're actually there yourself and you can see all these just beautiful, subtle colors. A lot of those colors formed because of the fumaroles, the steam vents that we don't see there anymore, but that were there and that gave the valley its name. There were fumaroles or steam vents just as far as the eye could see in this, at the time, very young valley of volcanic ash in 1916. And as that steam pushed its way up through to the surface, it chemically altered some of the ash and the rocks that were nearby. And that chemical alteration is part of the reason we see those different colors today.
So June 6, 1912, what happened?
My favorite account of what happened in 1912 was a story told by Harry Kayakakinak. He was 6 years old in 1912 when the volcano erupted, and we have an oral history from him from 1975. And I'm just going to quote young Harry in this because his description is so good. He says, "It was in the afternoon. That's when the volcano started. Started smelling like that fine pumice coming down. make a lot of noise. The size of rice, some of it smaller and some of it bigger, and some of it was as big as a kettle or pot. Cassia Bay started to get white gradually. That water used to be blue, flat, calm, no wind, and started to get white, white, white. And pretty soon, all white, and then dark, dark came. Dark didn't come all of a sudden. It comes gradually, getting darker and darker and darker and darker, and pretty soon, pitch black. So black, even if you put your hand 2 or 3 inches from your face outside, you can't see it because it was so dark.
I can't even conceive of what that must have been like to experience, especially back then when there's no communications and there's no, you can't just get on the internet and check the Alaska Volcanic Observatory and see what's going on.
Well, there had been a little bit of warning. There had been earthquakes in the days prior to the eruption, and oral histories told the people of the native villages there that that could lead to an eruption. And so some people had actually left the area already by the time the eruption occurred. But this is early June, and that's also the beginning of fishing season. And so there were some families who were along the coast putting up fish, including in Cassia Bay, which is where six-year-old Harry was when this happened. There were several settlements in the area that is now called Katmai National Park and Preserve. The closest to the site of the eruption was Yukak and then Old Savanovsky. And those were both heading towards the Ilyuk arm of Naknek Lake. And then going in the opposite direction, so south of Novorupta, where the eruption occurred, toward the coast, the village of Katmai would have been about the same distance away. Maybe 30 miles, something like that. The other thing that he doesn't mention, besides the amount of ash in the air and the darkness, was what this incredible noise must have been like. The sound of the eruption was heard in Anchorage, I believe. It was certainly heard in Kodiak, and it would have been heard on the Kenai Peninsula. So there was a tremendous roar that went along with this eruption.
So this eruption obviously had the potential to be deadly to anyone in the vicinity, but just through population in the area, it just wasn't a heavily populated area. And then the intelligence of the local residents to go, yeah, we're getting the heck out of here. So there was no loss of life in this event, correct?
That's correct. And the eruption was huge. It's important for us to understand today. We're talking about 3.1 cubic miles of magma getting exploded out of the earth in this eruption. So that is 30 times the amount that came out of the Mount St. Helens eruption in 1980. Ash was thrown 100,000 feet up into the stratosphere. That ash ended up encircling the entire earth. So it was a huge eruption, and if it had occurred in a more populated place or in an area where people had less literacy with respect to the land, it could truly have been deadly.
If you get to visit Katmai, or even if you look around on the website, you've got some great information there about Novorupta. The graphics, putting it in context around other volcanic eruptions that have happened, are really fascinating. I mean, you think Mount St. Helens, you think, you know, Vesuvius, you have these ideas in your head of these giant eruptions that we're familiar with. And then you see the plumes where you put things in order from the smallest to largest eruptions and where Novorupta falls on that. You just kind of look at that and go, oh, that is so much bigger than what I might have thought it was. Can you put that in a hierarchy or context compared to other eruptions that we might have heard of?
So the eruption at Novorupta was the largest volcanic eruption anywhere in the world in the entire 20th century. And the crazy thing is, so I was a geology major, but I had never heard of this eruption until I started thinking about moving to Katmai. So it's not a very well known outside of volcanology circles or people who are from the area or otherwise have some kind of connection to Katmai. And I think that needs to change because it's such an amazing story. So besides being the largest volcanic eruption of the 20th century, it also is of truly, you know, historic proportions, even on a longer time scale. Basically, in terms of recorded history, I'm aware of only 2 other volcanic eruptions that were larger than Novorupta. One was Mount Tambora in Indonesia in 1815, and the other was the eruption of Santorini in 1500 BCE. our area around here, of course, we're on the Ring of Fire around the Pacific, and so we are a much more volcanically active area. We get eruptions a lot more frequently here. So when Katmai was first established as a national monument in 1918, it was set aside specifically to protect the Valley of 10,000 Smokes and really very little area around that. The boundaries of the park have been expanded significantly in the decades since it was first established. But the intention in protecting the Valley of 10,000 Smokes was partly motivated because they were afraid that the geysers of Yellowstone were dying out, and they thought that there were going to be incredible geysers developing here. And so they wanted to sort of protect for the future this potential to have another Yellowstone. And it didn't pan out that way at all, of course, as the pyroclastic flows that filled in really in the Valley of 10,000 Smokes cooled. Then the fumaroles, the steams, the smokes began to die away. And we never did have geysers here.
That would have been very cool if you did. The valley is still very interesting without it. But I think that speaks to how young volcanology was when we first started going out and visiting the valley when Griggs first made it out there. Can you talk a little bit about the history of even the scientific approach to the eruption?
Yeah, well, remember that this first documentation of the Valley of 10,000 Smokes came from a botanist, not from a geologist. Robert Griggs was in the area studying plants. So the Valley of 10,000 Smokes was first described by a botanist. And although they started thinking about the geology of the area very quickly, there were a lot of things that took us decades to understand. And there are some questions that we still have today. The biggest surprise is that a lot of people at the time thought that the eruption originated from Mount Katmai. And they had good reasons for thinking that, because Mount Katmai used to have a nice peaky top. And after the eruption in 1912, the whole top of that mountain collapsed in, forming a caldera that became a beautiful crater lake. Today, if you're flying over that area or if you are hardy and make the trek up there, you can look into over the rim of Mount Katmai and down into this lake that's more than 800 feet deep. It is glorious. And so everyone thought at the time that that was where the eruption had come from. And it wasn't until quite a while later that it was understood that the eruption had actually vented from Nova Rupta, which was a site 6 miles away from Mount Katmai, kind of at the head of the Valley of 10,000 Smokes.
So visually, when you go out there, I would assume that anyone making the journey and then hiking all the way over to Nova Rupta has some background idea of what happened and the scale of all of this. And then to actually see Nova Rupta, and no offense, Nova Rupta, you are very cool in the jumble of weird, otherworldly, sci-fi looking, just mess of jumbly rock is really interesting. But the scale of Nova Rupta compared to this ring of volcanoes that surrounds it, it's like, really? That little tiny thing, that is what caused all of this, really?
Yeah, and so that is exactly the reaction that I had as well, because it isn't nearly as impressive as those soaring stratovolcanoes that you have surrounding you. Besides Mount Katmai, Mount Griggs is visible from the Valley of 10,000 Smokes, and it's one of those beautiful conical, just volcano-looking volcanoes. And then you have this little thing, but when you see it, especially from the air, you really can see the crater shape of Nova Rupta. And what's even more interesting is that you see the lava dome inside, which is basically the plug of lava that cooled right as the eruption was ending. And from a distance, you know, the lava plug just looks like a dome of harder rock. But you don't quite realize the scale to it right away until you get out there. Because that thing is 200 feet high. And it's something like a quarter of a mile across. And that was just what oozed out at the very end of the eruption.
Yeah, compared to Mount Katmai, well, now the shorter elevation of Mount Katmai, I guess.
Yeah, so Mount Katmai is today 6,715 feet high. But it did lose quite a bit of elevation in that eruption in 1912. Nova Rupta itself, the summit of Nova Rupta, is at an elevation of 2,760 feet. So not nearly as impressive. the story of how they figured out that Novorupka was the source is a fascinating one. They eventually figured that out by looking at ash depths and figuring out kind of where the ash must have originated. But there are some other really interesting stories about the volcanic eruption. For example, one of the characteristic kinds of rocks that you find near the source here is what we call banded pumice. And I actually have a piece of banded pumice sitting on my desk because it's weird. It is a strange rock. It's partly rhyolite and it's partly andesite. And these are two different volcanic rock types that in banded pumice are just kind of intermingled. So you get these like stripes of one and the other. And that's not normal. Normally, when you find pumice, it might be andesitic or it might be rhyolitic. But it's never both. And this was one of the great mysteries of volcanology for a little while, is how did this banded pumice come to form? And the answer actually has to do with how the mechanics of the Novorupka eruption worked. And it goes back to answer that question of, well, why did Mount Katmai collapse if the actual eruption was 6 miles away at Novorupka? And what we think happened is that there was a magma chamber beneath Mount Katmai, and somehow another body of magma worked its way up towards the surface and must have intercepted that magma chamber in some way, so that you had the magma that was sitting in the magma chamber below Mount Katmai, as well as this other magma, both pushing themselves kind of sideways over towards what became Novorupka. And the two different compositions of magma erupted at about the same time and were able to mix together.
Is there any thought on why the eruption site was Novorupka instead of Katmai?
It has to do, I think, with the fact that it was another deeper source of magma that was the one that was pushing its way towards the surface. And it was headed off more towards the side, towards Novorupka. That was where it wanted to erupt. And it just happened to run into this other smaller body of magma that was under Mount Katmai along the way.
So what was Novorupka before the eruption? Was there anything there or just a new vent? Because Novorupka means new volcano or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. And I actually don't know what was in that specific spot. But what you see at Novorupka today, this kind of pumicey crater with the lava plug in the middle, that's exactly the kind of thing that I would expect to see of a new volcano that had just formed in that particular spot. So I don't think that there necessarily was much of anything in that exact place beforehand. And we do know more about what the Valley of 10,000 Smokes was like. It would have looked much like any of the other valleys in this area. It would have been covered with a mix of tundra and shrubby, thick vegetation. And all of that was obliterated by the pyroclastic flows and the ash deposits that came out of Novorupka. The valley was buried up to 700 feet thick in ash in some places, and slowly decreasing the ash amount as you got further away from the eruption.
When you're walking out into the valley, you head up the west side of the River Lethe and look down into this deep, dramatic gorge that the river has carved, and you see different layers of sediment. What caused that?
Yeah, most of that deposition, I think, happened during a great big pyroclastic flow. And there are some YouTube videos that you can find showing more recent pyroclastic flows. Like I believe Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in the early 90s had a pretty devastating pyroclastic flow. A pyroclastic flow is incredibly hot ash that is heavier than air and ends up flowing downhill in a fiery furnace that can move faster than you can run. They're scary.
Well, that's terrifying.
And this was a really big one. And so it was that process, this turbulent, violent pyroclastic flow that deposited most of the material that filled up the Valley of 10,000 Smokes. The eruption took place over about 60 hours, so over 3 days, June 6th through 8th. But because you can think about how it was so turbulent, it was kind of swirling within, and then it cooled and hardened very gradually over a period of decades. And so those layers that you may see were kind of still forming during that time.
What made this eruption so powerful? Is that something to do with the rhyolite? I think that's particularly explosive.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Rhyolite, as a type of rock, is, when it's molten, it's very sticky or viscous. It has a lot of silicon dioxide in it. And silicon dioxide has this kind of pyramidal molecular structure to it. And so you can imagine if you melt a whole bunch of little pyramids, they don't flow past each other really easily. So it makes it super sticky. And rhyolite lava can flow. If you tried to pour it, it would be pouring about as fast as frozen molasses would flow, okay? Except extremely hot. And so because of that, it has a tendency to trap lots of bubbles of gas inside of it. And when you bring molten rock from deep below the earth where it's under high pressure, and you suddenly bring it up to the surface, it depressurizes, and all of those trapped gas bubbles expand with tremendous force. And it's that expansion that drives the powerful explosion that pushed ash 100,000 feet into the air. So there was enough ash sent into the atmosphere that it came down and was causing acid rain in Vancouver and Seattle. And the ash fall and the acid rain were enough that it was able to destroy laundry hanging on people's clotheslines. Now, from the archaeologist's perspective, in cutting into the soil in this region, you can see, if you go back over time, you can see many, many layers where there are thin coatings of ash over and over and over again. Because, of course, Nova Rupta is hardly by itself. There are 15 different active volcanoes today in Katmai National Park and Preserve alone. And that, of course, isn't counting the others that are along the Alaska Peninsula and out into the Aleutians.
And I think folks who live in this area are pretty familiar with what a pain ashfall can be. You know, if you were around when Redoubt erupted or when Augustine erupted or when Iliamna erupted, not so good for cars, not so good for respiratory illnesses.
Because basically volcanic ash is just tiny little needles of glass. And that is no good for anything except for geologists.
And the way that that ash fall, the direction that it traveled, Kodiak was not so much a fun place at the time, right?
No, Kodiak suffered 3 days of darkness and very thick ash falls that were measured, I want to say, like 6 inches or a foot of ash. So a really challenging place to be. A lot of people who were in kind of that immediate downfall area, they ended up being evacuated, though, by ship.
Oh, yeah, completely overcrowded on this ship. And then the ship couldn't go anywhere because there was so much ash, they couldn't get out of the harbor. Mm-hmm. And they just kind of ended up holding
up. You have done your research. This is great.
I nerded out on this one. This was very fascinating to me. And speaking of moonscape out there, as far as other trivia about the valley, NASA used to train astronauts out there.
Well, I actually love it when people refer to the Valley of 10,000 Smokes as a moonscape because it connects back to the 1960s when astronauts were training for the moon landings. And they had to try to find someplace on Earth where the astronauts could train for the type of loose, ashy terrain that we thought it was likely they'd encounter on the moon. And so several of those Apollo astronauts came to Katmai and trained in the Valley of 10,000 Smokes. I believe Buzz Aldrin was one of them.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
When I was out there, I kind of wanted to do the bouncy on the moon astronaut walk kind of thing, but I had a multi-day pack on at the time, so that didn't go very kind of hard to bounce when you're carrying like 35 pounds.
So much more pesky gravity than the moon does.
Yeah, that really although one of my other fun things to do out there was to pick up a giant rock of pumice with one hand and made me feel incredibly strong, but of course pumice weighs next to nothing rock wise for its size, so it makes for good photo opportunities, but does not necessarily correlate.
I too have photos of myself hefting large pumice boulders.
I think everybody does. That's one of the things that one of the standard shots I think that you get if you visit the valley is holding these giant looking rocks that really way yeah. next to nothing.
Yeah, well, and, you know, we learn in school about, you know, this rock called pumice that can float in water, but you come to Katmai and you go to, let's say, Brooks Camp, and there the whole beach is made up of pumice, and you take a piece of pumice and you can set it on the surface of the water and it floats. And even though you know that that's what's going to happen, it's still the most amazing thing ever.
Yeah, kind of hard to wrap your head around that. We are trying to wrap our heads around the Valley of 10,000 Smokes here on the Kenai Conversation, which doubles as Adventure Talks this morning. I'm Jenny Nyman, speaking with Kathy Bell, Chief of Interpretation and Education at Katmai National Park and Preserve. And if you want to find out more about the Valley and see some of the things we've been discussing, I'll be doing a photo presentation at 7 p.m. Friday at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. Kathy, what's one of your favorite views in the Valley?
People sometimes use the word devastation to describe how the Novarupta eruption affected the Valley of 10,000 Smokes. But I actually don't like to look at it as devastation. I like to look at it as the creation of new land. And it did. It just, you know, it did kill everything that was growing in the valley, everything that got buried underneath, all of that volcanic ash. But life is creeping back into the valley. And I like to think that Robert Griggs, if he were around today, he would have a lot of fun studying the way that plants are slowly creeping back into the Valley of 10,000 Smokes.
That was another surprising thing to me, because you hear about how, you know, obviously plants aren't going to grow up through the still feet and feet and feet of ash that's covering everything. But on the top, slowly getting a foothold, or little tufts of grasses and flowers even here and there.
Well, I was pretty excited about seeing the plants out there myself. For my master's, I studied alpine plants in Sequoia National Park. So I was up in the very high Sierra Nevada in California. But I saw a lot of close cousins to alpine plants growing out there in the Valley of 10,000 Smokes, because the plants here in that situation really face a lot of the same challenges that they do in very, very high mountains much farther south. Some of it is a fairly short growing season. Some of it is that soil, but there isn't any organic matter in that soil. There aren't a lot of nutrients, and water just drains right through it. And so plants that can make it at the edges of the Valley of 10,000 Smokes, they are survivors. And I always want to give them a cheer when I see them. Some of them have been around for quite a while, too. I saw big cushions of moss campion, for example, is one that stands out in my memory, that grow kind of radially outward as a low cushion plant. And it takes a long time for that to happen. And the size of some of these, I felt comfortable saying that they had been there for many decades out of this 105 years since Novarupta exploded.
There was wildlife out there, too, which I was surprised at again, because what are they eating out there? There were birds flitting around, picking at stuff in the ground. My party happened to luck out and see a herd of caribou go tromping by, including a bunch of little calves.
Did you really?
Yeah.
That's a rare treat.
Yeah, we were over by cool. Mount McGeek, and they crossed that mm-hmm. lake outlet and then uh-huh. went up the side mm-hmm. and across the glacier, and off they went. So that was
wow. That
was very cool.
Well, that's a real treat. That is not something that everybody gets to see on their valley trip.
And we did not get to see who left these prints, but on that ejecta ring, right, the one right in close around Novarupta, there were some big old bear prints. And I mean, obviously there's nothing out there for a bear to eat, other than we started thinking like, man, if a bear were really hungry, we would be the only thing for a bear to eat. But obviously there's reason for bears to be in that area, and they can, you know, cover so much distance. It's probably not much for them to just yeah. hop down through the valley and go on about their magical merry way.
I was out in the Valley of 10,000 Smokes for my birthday this past July, and I did see a bear cruising around one afternoon, and then on the following morning on the steep slopes of the Buttress Range over on the side of the valley, actually not too far above where I had made camp. You know, it was a couple hundred yards away, probably more than that, probably more like 400, 500 yards away, but close enough that I could see it fairly well and watch it for quite a while as it moved around on the mountainside.
At least out there, you can see things from a very long way. You're not liable to spook a bear coming around a corner and there's a stream and it can't hear you. It's generally, it's going to know you're there, and you're going to know it's there, and that probably adds to the safety factor.
But it is important for people who are planning their backpacking trips going out there to plan with bear safety in mind. We have bear canisters available for loan at the visitor center at Brooks Camp. And so anyone going out there should pick up one of those and take it with them. Because even though the valley itself may seem inhospitable to bears, as you saw, as I saw, bears can and do use that area. And so it's really important to make sure that you practice good practices in terms of securing food and protecting it from bears.
Right. And anyone who goes to the valley is like 99% sure to pass through Brooks Camp. You could come up from the other way and just have an incredibly mm-hmm. long hike, or, you know, pay for a charter flight and get dropped off kind of thing. But by and large, I think mm-hmm. most people come through Brooks Camp. And honestly, I think that's probably much more of a draw than the valley, because you've got the bear viewing there, right? The world famous Brooks Falls.
I got to talk to a lot of visitors this summer who were attracted to Katmai, of course, because of Brooks Falls and the bear viewing. But they had enough time in their schedules to plan a trip for a backpacking trip in the Valley of 10,000 Smokes as well. And universally, of the people that I talked to who were able to do that, they came out and they were like, we came for the bears, we fell in love with the valley.
Yep, definitely.
Well, and we park rangers are trying to solve that. because circling back, you know, the whole reason that we were established as a national monument in the first place in 1918 was because of the Valley of 10,000 Smokes. And so we really try to get the word out and let people know that this incredible thing, this site of the largest volcanic eruption in the 20th century, is right here. And anyone coming to Katmai can visit it. It's a pretty incredible resource.
And I grew up in Alaska, and of course you take some Alaska mm-hmm. studies classes along the way, and you take science classes along the way. Never heard of it. Never heard of it until I did a story on someone who did a photo project out there and was just fascinated by the pictures that he took and the stories he told of being out there, and like the biggest eruption in the what is right across the seriously? Why have I never heard of this before?
Yeah. The Valley of 10,000 Smokes is a great destination for Alaskans, I think, partly because it's such a cool piece of state-specific history, but also just because the landscape looks so different than really anything you'll experience anywhere else in the state.
So what does it take to get out there? What should folks be planning for, keeping in mind if they're going to go?
So it definitely takes some effort to get out there. Most people coming to Katmai fly to King Salmon on a commercial flight and then take a float plane from there to Brooks Camp. We do also get a lot of folks who are coming in from Homer. That's a big source for sending people to Katmai. Almost everyone who's planning on backpacking in the Valley of 10,000 Smokes is going to arrive at Brooks Camp. And like any visitor arriving at Brooks Camp, their first stop will be at the visitor center so we can give a detailed bear safety orientation. After going through that, that's a great time to talk with the ranger about what your plans are. And we can give a lot more specific advice about how to travel safely in the Valley of 10,000 Smokes. It sounds like you had pretty good weather on your trip. Is that right?
Well, we did and we didn't. It was mostly dry. It kind of rained on us one day, but the wind. So the benefit of not having anything out there is this just striking, vast landscape that you get to gaze upon and consider your puny status in the universe. The downside of that is there is nothing to block that wind. And of course, the wind through all that volcanic material is picking up all kinds of sediment and just pummeling you with pumice, basically. Not the most pleasurable hiking conditions. That when that wind picks up, that was rather unpleasant. I will say that for sure. It's a challenging environment if you're not prepared for that.
It is. And so preparedness is key, and not just in terms of thinking about bear safety, but also really being prepared for anything that the Alaska climate can throw at you. You may get beautiful, clear days that are calm with sunshine, but it's unlikely that you'll get those for every day of your trip. Those high winds can really pick up, and they can be pretty brutal, so you really want to make sure that you're staking down a tent or anything like that very, very securely, that you have good ways of protecting your face, you know. So carrying a bandana or something like that you can pull across your nose and mouth is actually really helpful. And then the other thing to be prepared for is that, of course, it can rain in the summertime, and the fog can get really, really thick. And it can be difficult to navigate in the Valley of 10,000 Smokes when it clouds up and you can't see any landmarks. So having really good compass skills and backcountry navigation skills becomes very important, too.
There's another challenge to travel, and that's geography. There's two rivers that flow down through the valley, Knife Creek on the east side and the River Lethe on the west. To get into the valley, most people walk out along the base of the West Buttress Range in between that and the River Lethe. And to get from over there to Novarupta, you have to cross the River Lethe. And you can't do that anywhere along the way. There's only certain spots where that's going to happen. And you can't see where those spots are when you're all nice and snug and protected against the West Buttress. You need to get out in the middle of the valley and kind of walk along that gorge and find the spots to do that. So, yeah, navigation, just finding a place where we could get across that river was, yeah, a little bit challenging.
Yeah, and well, I have two comments about that. That's one of the reasons why it's really important to talk to a park ranger when you arrive at Burks Camp, because they can help give you directions and help you find your bearings to find your way to the safe ford areas where it's going to have a safer crossing of the River Lethe. The second thing is, as you point out, the River Lethe, there are a few spots where accessing it is via kind of a broad, shallow plain. But in most places, it has carved deeply down into the volcanic ash. And it is really startling to think about how it has cut down so far in such a short amount of time, only a little over 100 years. We're so used to seeing or hearing about big canyons and thinking, oh, they take millions of years for the water to cut down and form this. And here you can come to the Valley of 10,000 Smokes and you can see these sharp-edged, dramatic drop-offs that are only a century old.
Yeah, that was pretty impressive. And it made, on one hand, you're kind of nervous about, okay, where am I going to cross? Where am I going to cross? Where am I going to cross? But especially when you're the first couple miles when you're hiking out there, like, well, clearly not here. So I'm just not going to worry about it yet, because there is no way you were getting across some of those chasms.
No, and you shouldn't try. You want to go upstream several miles before you kind of swing over and start heading towards Novarupta, and you're able to make that crossing a little bit more safely.
Definitely. Yeah, we found a couple spots, kind of mid-valley-ish, but up about 7 miles up, and then up around Mount McGeek as well. It got a little easier to navigate that river. And it's, again, pre-warning, something that the rangers definitely told us about, is it might look like a pretty safe place to cross, and it might look shallow and the water might look pretty tame there, but there can be some deep spots that you just can't see. So cross carefully and link up arms and unfasten your pack belt and all that good stuff.
Yeah, unfastening your pack belts and having hiking poles or some kind of staff or something that you can use too for probing ahead. Those are really important safety precautions, really anytime you're fording, but especially here where there's often enough material sediment in the water that you can't necessarily see the bottom very well.
And also along the lines of camping and being prepared, that's one of the few places that I've ever been where it's really incredibly important to put some thought into where you're going to camp. Because out in the middle of that valley is just not hospitable for throwing up a tent. So we were very thoughtful about, okay, first night for sure along the West Buttress. And then from there, either you go up to the lake around Mount McGeek, or it's a pretty long day, but maybe you get all the way up to Novarupta. And then the baked mountain huts are a very helpful helpful landing spot if the weather really is bad. And it's not like some parks where you have to register for a campsite. There are no campsites out there in the sense that we might be used to for national parks. So planning ahead and having an idea of where you're going to camp, also because there's not many water sources out there.
Yeah, that's a big factor. And so tucking in against the buttress range is a pretty good option for protecting yourself against the wind and also being able to find a nice little creek, which will be a good water source for you.
We were out there in end of June and, you know, summer. So Wasn't expecting a lot of snow out there, but there was still plenty of snow around Nova Rupta. So we didn't camp there, but if we had, there would have been snow to melt. It would have been grainy water, but we could have made that work for water. The baked mountain huts, how does that work? Because we definitely hold up in there for a couple days, too, to get out of the wind. And it's kind of like, well, if nobody's there, feel free.
You don't want to rely on the baked mountain huts as your... You don't want to have that as your only available source of shelter. It's important to be prepared to camp in a tent and to have those supplies with you. The Baked Mountain huts are owned and operated by the U.S. Geological Survey, and so they're used for researchers who are out there. To this day, Nova Rupta remains a very highly studied volcano. The whole Katmai area, of course, is highly studied. And so researchers will have and will sometimes be using those huts. So you can't always count on there being space available. But when they're vacant, as I guess they were for you, they are a nice resource.
Yep. We lucked out. We only saw one other group of campers when we were out there. We passed a group coming out as we were going in the first day. And then there was a lady and her son were out there when we were out there. But as far as a backcountry experience goes, it's always kind of cool to be somewhere where you're not seeing a lot of other humans just because it adds to the backcountry feel. But on the other side of that is, man, if we have a problem, we're on our own. Nobody else is out here to help out.
Yeah, and that sums up wilderness and Alaskan wilderness in particular. It's very important to be self-sufficient and be prepared for any situation that the weather and conditions might throw at you.
If you are interested in a backcountry experience, the Valley of 10,000 Smokes is certainly that. I'm Jenny Nyman. You're listening to Adventure Talks on the Kenai Conversation. I'm speaking with Kathy Bell, Chief of Interpretation and Education at Katmai National Park and Preserve. She's educating us on some of the things you'll see if you make it out to the valley. One of the more interesting things are the features for which the valley got its name, the fumaroles, the 10,000, give or take. It's not like anyone actually counted all of them. Smoke-producing vents that Robert Griggs saw when he first visited the valley after Nova Rupta exploded in 1912. And that's where the colors come from, right? What are you seeing when you're stumbling along and all of a sudden you're in the middle of this rainbow going on the valley floor?
Yeah, so sometimes you'll see this even where the River Lethe has cut down along the side of where a fumarole used to be. And you can actually see how the rock all around this kind of vertical path that was the vent where steam rose up through the ash and emerged at the surface. You can see kind of rings of colors going out from that center vent. And that's because of the extremely hot and probably acidic steam that was coming out and chemically altering the rocks on either side and weathering them very quickly into oxides that would have those bright colors.
What causes the differentiation of colors out there? Because there was everything from pastel hues to just really vibrant oranges and purples. Yeah. The differentiation of color out there was really interesting.
One way that you can get different colors, typically when you're weathering rocks, is when you have slightly different trace minerals in the rock to begin with. So famously, of course, where you have iron, you're going to get that rusty red kind of color. Purples, I think, often come when you have trace elements of manganese. I think sometimes those green colors might come from small amounts of copper. And I'm sure that there are other things out there in small amounts, too, that can affect the colors.
It was one of those fun things to just wander around and go, how the heck did that happen? Especially on the backside of Broken Mountain and Baked Mountain when you're overlooking Nova Rupta. It's just these huge bands of colors, like you're walking literally in a prism. Yeah. It was crazy.
Yeah, and so when you're seeing those different bands of color in the same kind of rock, or when you're seeing the color kind of changing as you move outward from the center of what had been a fumarole, there I think you're looking at differences in the temperature and the amount of moisture that the rock would have been exposed to and that it would have been chemically changed by. So you're going to get kind of a more intense reaction and closer to the source of the steam where it's really hot and where there's a lot of moisture available. versus as you work your way a little bit deeper into the rock and further away, it's going to be cooler and less moist.
What you see in the valley today is the remains of those fumaroles. There certainly aren't 10,000 still active today. Are there any?
You know, I have not managed to find any active fumaroles out in the valley myself, but a couple of my rangers did this summer, so I believe that there are at least two out there that the lucky hiker might stumble across. We do actually have active fumaroles elsewhere in the park, like at the summit of Mount Martin, where there's a very small acid crater lake, and then lots of venting fumaroles right there. But for the most part, the Valley of 10,000 Smokes is now smokeless.
Although I will say, and I have pictures to prove this, Nova Rupta itself, there was some steam coming out of that. And maybe it was just because there was snow in there and it was heating. I don't know what the cause of that was, but there was definitely some steam coming out of there. So is that vent site still active at all?
Well, I guess that all comes back to how you define an active volcano, but it is on our list of 15 active volcanoes for the park, yeah.
Okay, well, that was a little nerve-wracking when we're standing there seeing puffs come out of it, like, I don't know.
Well, so was everything else around you.
Oh, good point, yeah, okay.
They were all active volcanoes.
False sense of security when you look up at, like, Mount Griggs and Trident, and they're all covered in snow. And I mean, I know that actually means nothing in terms of volcanic activity, but like, that's nice and cool over there. But when you're looking at Nova Rupta and it's just this jumbled, otherworldly mass, and then to see steam coming out of it, that was more unsettling than to consider these giant volcanoes all around you, but to see the little puffs of steam out of this little tiny hill of rocks was, for whatever non-scientific mental reasoning, that was a little more uncomfortable than to think of the larger scale of where you are.
It's funny, isn't it, how our brains work.
Or don't work very well, as the case may be. That is Kathy Bell, Chief of Interpretation and Education at Katmai National Park and Preserve, on KDLL Adventure Talks, which doubles as the Kenai conversation today. We're talking about visiting the Valley of 10,000 Smokes in Katmai. If this sounds like an interesting trip, come to the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center at 7 p.m. Friday to see if it looks like an interesting trip, because we'll be doing a photo presentation and question and answer session. Kathy, what else should folks know?
Gosh, I think we covered things pretty well, really. I guess the thing I'd like to emphasize most is definitely to take the opportunity while at Brooks Camp to stop and chat with the ranger. Conditions do change, and the rangers can give the most current and up-to-date information that'll help you have a safe and enjoyable trip.
Okay, when are good time frames to be out there? I mean, I don't imagine that bus runs in December, so when should people be looking at booking their trips if they're interested?
Most people interested in doing a backpacking trip in the Valley of 10,000 Smokes are going to come between mid-June and probably about mid-September. So it's about the same season that Brooks Camp is open itself. It does get significantly rainier as the summer goes on, and so your chances of having good weather are a little bit better in late June or early July than they are if you come in, let's say, late August or early September.
And you don't have to actually schlep a bag miles upon miles out into the valley to get to see it. The bus that takes you out there is a day trip, actually. So you stop at a cool cabin overlook, and there's all kinds of really great interpretive displays, and there's a park ranger to lead you on a day hike. So you don't have to actually walk all the way out there to see the valley. There's a gentler option to go check that out if you're more interested in that approach.
Yeah, that's right. And that's a great way to get a feel for it, especially if you don't have a lot of time or if you're not prepared for doing a backpacking trip. As you mentioned, it's a one-day trip where you can take the bus out to a visitor center that looks over the Valley of 10,000 Smokes from the valley's foot. And then there's an optional day hike with the ranger that takes you down to Utak Falls, and you get to see this really thick layer of tuff, the volcanic rock that was deposited in the pyroclastic flows, and you get to see how that's been carved into, and then you can hike back up and enjoy the view from that overlook again, have some lunch, and then take a bus on back to Brooks Camp. It is a wonderful way to spend a day.
And one other logistical thing that my group ended up having to deal with, the way that the flight scheduling ended up, we weren't able to get in to Brooks Camp in time to catch the bus, and vice versa. We weren't able to catch the bus and catch a flight out of Brooks Camp, so we ended up needing to camp there at Brooks. And there are some challenges with that. It is a very popular place, especially when the fish are running, because when the fish are running, the bears are there eating the fish.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about camping availability and how that works in Brooks Camp.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. There's a campground at Brooks Camp, but as you mentioned, it's a very popular campground, and it opens to take reservations in early January, and at least for the month of July, that campground tends to completely fill up through reservations within hours of it opening for reservations. So if that's something you're interested in doing, particularly in July, which is our peak time of year for bear activity and therefore for human activity at Brooks Camp, it's a good idea to go to recreation.gov and look up Brooks Camp in Katmai National Park and Preserve and see when the reservation period is going to become active, and then act immediately when it opens for reservations to make that. So recreation.gov.
But if you're not lucky enough to get one of the sites in the campground, mm-hmm. you can still be there overnight.
Yeah.
But you have to walk a bit, right? You're not allowed to just camp.
You do. Yeah. So for folks who aren't able to get a reserved spot at the campground, it's always worth stopping by and checking with the rangers, because sometimes there's been a last-minute cancellation and you'll be able to get a spot at the campground after all. Even without that, if you're set up for backpacking anyway, it's not too difficult to hike outside of the Brooks Camp area. Once you're far enough away from Brooks Camp, you can set up camp there, too.
It was kind of a, you know, check your perspective moment for us when we went out there, because we were kind of aggrieved that the flight didn't line up with the bus, and because we were going specifically to go to the valley. So, of course, we wanted as much time out there as possible. Like, what? We have to waste a day on each end in Brooks Camp? What is that about? And then the more we think about it, wait, this is a world-class destination. This is a trip of a lifetime for people to be in Brooks Camp. And we're like, well, we have to sit in Brooks Camp. So, of course, what do? We go out to the falls and watch these giant bears. And we were a little before the run started, so it wasn't crazy bear central quite yet. But it also meant that we had more opportunity to hang out and watch the bears that were there. So, yeah, you might end up having to camp there when maybe that wasn't your original plan. But have an open mind. Enjoy it, because that part of the trip alone is worth any price of admission that it takes to get out there.
Yeah, I strongly encourage people when planning a backpacking trip to the Valley of 10,000 Smokes to leave a bit of cushion on both before and after their trip, and take that time and spend it at Brooks Camp and enjoy seeing the bear activity. Enjoy being there. It's a beautiful location that looks and feels entirely different from the Valley of 10,000 Smokes. And so by doing both, I think you get to have a more complete Katmai experience than you would if you just went to one or just went to the other.
Definitely. There's hiking around there. You know, if you brought a pack raft or something, you could paddle around the lake. There's obviously the bears. There's just world-class fishing. It is, in and of itself, mm-hmm. Brooks Camp alone is an incredible destination. So don't skimp on that part when you're going out to the valley. And bear awareness, of course, remains paramount anywhere in Brooks Camp. I was so impressed with how the bear-human interaction was managed out there. It is the strictest park that I've ever been to as far as bear safety, and don't have food anywhere where you sleep, and bear canisters and all that stuff is required. But just the way that the Park Service prioritizes the bears in a way, I kind of felt like it was a zoo, but instead of the bears being cordoned off, the people were the ones behind the barriers. And it was really interesting to see that. So you're walking through camp and there's just people everywhere with radios and just keeping an eye out for bears. But when bears come through, the bears aren't the ones shooed off. People are, okay, you're just going to have to wait here until the all clear. Nope, sorry. We don't care what you got going on over there. Bears have the right of way. And at the falls, there's these just great overlooks, and you get such an incredible view. But you're not interfering with the bears. And it's such an interesting kind of different approach than, I think, wildlife in a lot of other places where the wildlife is being restricted and shooed off and kept away from the people. But at Brooks Camp, it's the people's responsibility to not interfere with the bears and to keep them wild. It was really interesting, and it made me feel a lot safer than many other places that I've been.
Well, I can't tell you how glad it makes me to hear that, because we put a lot of work into people management at Brooks Camp. And as you're pointing out, the Brooks River area is home for our wild bears, and we are just visitors there. And when I say we, I'm including us, the people who work here at Katmai. And so you're right, we always yield to the bears. They have the right to use that river, and we are going to respect that. One reason for the camping restriction is that the bears are experienced in the Brooks Camp area, and they have a pretty good understanding, if I may use that word, of when and where they're most likely to encounter people. And they're fairly tolerant within those limits. And so it's important for us to respect those limits. And that's part of the reason why it's tremendously important to, say, eat food only indoors or in the designated picnic areas. By not having any food anywhere else, that helps us prevent a lot of problems. It's like nothing else in the world. It is truly like nothing else in the world. And it's a tremendous privilege, I think, to be able to get to observe wild bears being wild, doing wild things from the kind of close vantage points that we have access to in Brooks Camp and along the Brooks River.
Right. Well, like nothing else in the world, I think, could be said for the valley as well.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for taking so much time. I could probably obviously talk about this for hours upon hours on end, but radio time being what it is, and I'm sure your time being what it is, we should probably wrap up.
I've enjoyed talking with you about this very much, and it's great to hear that you had such a good trip out there yourself.
All right. Well, Kathy, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing so much useful and fascinating information. It is much appreciated.
It's an amazing place, and I love it very much, so I'm glad to share it with others.
All right. Well, we'll see if we can talk some folks from around here to getting out there as well. I'm, definitely beating the drum for visiting. It was a very cool trip.
Yeah, it's a wonderful destination for Alaskans, just because it is such a change from anything else, I think, in the state.
All right. Well, I will let you get about your Park Service business today. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk.
Thank you. Have a great day.
That was Kathy Bell, Chief of Interpretation and Education at Katmai National Park and Preserve, talking about the Valley of 10,000 Smokes. If you'd like to learn more and see some of the things we've been describing, I'll be doing a photo presentation at 7 p.m. Friday at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. It's free for KDLL members or $5 for non-members. And of course, you can always become a member and support KDLL by making a donation through our website, kdll.org. And if you want a refresher course before the presentation Friday, you can find a podcast version of this show on that very same website under the podcast heading. I'm Jenny Nyman. This has been Adventure Talks. Thanks for tuning in.